So I'm going to make a confession that I have not studied with extensive and thorough, in fact, not much at all, the really most important aspect of the elections that are going to be ending on November 6th. Of course, they've been going on for weeks with this sort of absentee voting and the ability to go to polling places early. Those are the propositions that actually, some of which have some meaningful chance of changing things for people who are poor, people who are working class, ordinary folks. A lot of the propositions are mostly for the worse, and it's the lesser of two evils. But I've noticed a couple of them, at least one of them, which I'm going to be openly endorsing, and I think that it's no surprise that I endorse Proposition 10, which is the repeal of the Costa-Hawkins Act, which allows, the repeal will allow cities to establish rent control, which I haven't got a lot of great hopes for that, but it is a sort of a minor break on escalating profiteering and immiseration being produced by the real estate lobby and the real estate folks who want to, well, put ordinary people in a position of having to move out of the communities that they've lived in all their lives. Poor people become poor people, at least poor in the sense they can't afford the rents, given the kind of wages they're paid or the kinds of benefits they get if they can't work. So that's a situation which you can help to alleviate by voting yes on Proposition 10. Similarly, with the Santa Cruz City, if you vote yes on Measure M, that's a rent control and just eviction protection, you will get a kind of rent control and a kind of just eviction, which doesn't reduce rents, which I'd like to see, but at least it holds them somewhat steadier than they are now, substantially. Actually, we've had a rent freeze since February, but that's because of this ballot measure, which had the city council running scared that they would have to face even more difficult times if landlords were allowed to hysterically raise their rents in anticipation of a possible victory at the polls. I frankly don't think Proposition M is going to win. Too much has been spent against it. But, and ditto with, I'm sorry, Measure M. It's Measure M and Proposition 10. But both of those you should vote for if you bother to go to the ballot box. And that's going to be the subject of the next articles I'm going to be reading to you, which gives you a sort of a debate on so-called lesser evil voting, because that's what all this about. It's about really voting for the worse guy or the less worse guy, the horrible proposition or the somewhat less horrible proposition. And as in the case of Measure M and Proposition 10, if you're really looking for real change, that's still true. But if you are you can vote for some substantial, at least holding in check, rental profiteering. At least that's the hope of those who have put this proposition and resolution forward. But what about the whole idea of voting for the pre-selected candidates and the pre-selected propositions that actually have been put there by forces with a lot of money and power and probably don't have much to do with the common man, the ordinary woman, the person on the street, and particularly poor people, and almost definitely homeless people. Here's an article called Why the Democratic Party Can't Be Saved by Nick Pemberton, because I would remind you that most people are going to be voting for the Democrats, some for the Greens, some for the Socialists. It's not a bad alternative in either case, although they have their problems too. But here's a guy who writes on the Counterpunch website, Nick Pemberton, who discusses and deconstructs the whole idea of voting in a rigged system anyway. And here is what he writes. First, he quotes from Noam Chomsky, as a famous political leftist who I think many of my listeners have probably read or heard even on this station. And Chomsky says, according to this quote, there are two issues. One is a kind of moral issue. Do you vote against the greater evil if you don't happen to like the other candidate? The answer to that is yes. If you have any moral understanding, you want to keep the greater evil out. Second is a factual question. How did Trump and Clinton, we're going back to 2016, he's reviewing that, compare? I think they're very different, Chomsky says. I didn't like Clinton at all, but her positions are much better than Trump's on every issue I can think of. And then a second quote is given at this article by a woman named Emma Watson, who I've never heard of before, probably should have. If not me, who? If not now, when? And here's his article. Oh, yes, the second quote is originally from Hillel the Elder, but Watson made it famous and will factor in later. First to Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky is too smart to ever lie, but maybe just a little too smart to have hope. Regardless, he is one of the great figures of our lifetime. Evaluating Chomsky's opinions on lesser evil voting is difficult because he seems to be right on just about everything else. I'm not one of the people on the left who sees no difference between the two parties. Trump is especially bad. The difference between the two parties is obviously great enough where one would be right to commit their night to keeping the Republicans out, no matter how much one might disagree with the Democrats. The act of voting is not always that easy in our democracy, however. Greg Palast has been keeping track of the recent voter purges in the United States. Things were especially bleak in Georgia, as the GOP purged 1 in 10 voters. How outrageous. Palast notes the racism of the purging method cross-check. 1 in 6 Latinos are on the cross-check lists. 1 in 9 blacks are. This is a strategic move. Republicans know they can count on dumbed-down whites to vote them in just based on racial identity alone. How else does the dreadful GOP keep on winning? Mitch McConnell just blamed the federal deficit on Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. Polls show the vast majority of people want to keep these programs, yet goons like McConnell continue to get elected. Voter suppression, absurd campaign spending, mass disinformation, and a deplorable, dumbed-down, and bigoted population are the only things the Republicans have going for them. That is, besides their secret weapon. A sham, quote, resistance party, quote unquote, that is most focused on compromise and corporate backing rather than the will of the people. That's the Democrats he's talking about. Still, there remain differences between the two corporate parties, so I also agree with the moral issue Chomsky raises. Not liking a Democrat is no reason not to vote for them. Doing so puts one's own feelings above the well-being of working-class people across the globe, and I do see this as a problem on the left sometimes. We are sometimes most motivated by a hatred of Democrats for whatever reason. Maybe it is a rebellion against liberalism. Maybe it is because it makes us sound ahead of the curve. Maybe it is because we have too much faith in the Democrats and see them as a friend that is letting us down. Regardless, I find the most healthy thing to do is to be honest about it. The Democrats are really bad, and liberalism doesn't cut it most of the time, but they remain far better than the Republicans. But here I must begin my disagreement with Chomsky. He seems to identify just a small portion of the country who feels this way, even if every single one of them has a blog. The assumption that most third-party voters or non-voters are acting without moral or factual guidance is simply not true. There is a pragmatism to not voting for the Democrats. Anyone would admit, Chomsky included, that both parties have gotten far worse and that the strategy of lesser evil voting has not prevented this from happening. If simply voting for the lesser evil is our only voting principle, then we rely solely on relativity. There are no lines drawn in the sand for what we feel is right and wrong. But to Chomsky's credit, he has a very reasonable response to this as well. I'm sure he would recognize that radicalism is most often rational and moral. He might also agree with me that the radicals are the only rational and moral people in our political system. But Chomsky argues that electoral politics are not often the place where radical change occurs. W.B. Du Bois, a writer from the late 19th and early 20th century, who fought for racial justice and just justice generally, he was a brilliant writer, had a similar understanding when he called voting an act of self-defense. There are things you can control in the outcomes of elections, and Chomsky believes that you should control these outcomes. To use another famous quote from Reinhold Niebuhr, "God grant me the security to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference." It's hard to refute. A vote for a third party in most parts of the country is simply a protest vote that takes the voter out of any likely outcomes for the particular election. A vote for nobody is an even bigger protest with even less likely chance of impacting the election results in a positive way. The voting system is so rigged that any decent candidates are simply left out of the process and would be sabotaged if they figured a way in. Note Bernie Sanders, who I'll have some harsh words for later. Chomsky argues that we shouldn't be focused on electoral politics. It is far more important to be engaged citizens the rest of the year. We are in full agreement here. I also would concur that while lesser evil voting surely hasn't made either party any better, it has saved us from some Republicans, which is a godsend. Noam Chomsky, then, is partly correct, I think. Radical politics are necessary. Electoral politics don't give us radical outcomes at this point in time. Better results in a specific election can be achieved by voting for a lesser evil. But I must break from Chomsky. I understand that he believes voting can and should be separated from being a radical in today's dark times. But for better or worse, voting remains a huge part of our political culture. Advocating for a lesser evil undermines radical candidates, plain and simple. It even undermines not-so-radical candidates who could significantly change America for the better. I am talking here about the Bernie Sanders campaign. Bernie ultimately had the same attitude as Chomsky did about elections. Presenting big and exciting ideas is okay, but it is impossible to actually get them to happen via electoral politics. When Bernie Sanders endorsed Hillary Clinton, he undermined the entire movement he created. One could argue that the cynical endorsement may have defeated Donald Trump's. Oops, it didn't. But Bernie's surrender also had other rational consequences besides potentially keeping the far greater Donald Trump out of office. One rational consequence was that the Sanders movement was smothered, a consequence that without question outweighed the difference between Clinton and Trump. Refusing to believe that electoral politics can and should be a place for radical politics ignores popular movements across the world, particularly in South America, movements, of course, which the imperialist Bernie Sanders would undermine. Chomsky notes that Bernie Sanders' success was by far the most remarkable thing to happen in the 2016 election, and he was right. A grumpy, unknown old guy captured an entire country's imagination with no money, no press support, no support from his political party, and really no allies in popular culture or discourse whatsoever. As Chomsky would say, remarkable. Clearly, then, the American public is more radical than we think. And clearly, this portion of the country often is disengaged from electoral politics. By giving up on his movement before it really started, Bernie Sanders guaranteed that a radical outcome in electoral politics was not possible. He could have tried and seen what happened, but he didn't. I remember a Noam Chomsky interview on Democracy Now! During the Democratic Party primaries. Amy Goodman asked him who he favored, and he said Bernie Sanders in the primary. But he also made it sure to note that he would support Clinton in the general election if she beat Sanders in the primary. This seemed like an unnecessary early endorsement. Sanders, too, made sure to put out any fires before they started, opting never to criticize Clinton during the primaries. Was it old-fashioned chivalry that held these men back, or was it something more severe? One really has to ask Mr. Chomsky, who calls himself a radical, and Mr. Sanders, who calls himself a revolutionary, what exactly were the goals of the Sanders campaign? Was the goal ever at any point in time to actually gain power? Because we now see the Sanders-backed candidates mostly getting crushed in the 2018 midterms, and it's because they're outspent. And Sanders will complain, Chomsky will complain, but why would the 1% care? There is a belief here that radical politics will never be possible in the United States. Sanders wasn't even a radical. He was a mad dog imperialist with some reform capitalism on the brain. But clearly, Chomsky and Sanders thought this was way too left for the average American. The reason why no one votes in America is not because we are all a bunch of snobs. It's because people get invested in politics or invested in anything when something good can come out of it. Sanders, a relatively sane but complicit Democrat, was such a breath of fresh air that millions came out to organize, vote, and knock doors. Clearly, though, Mr. Sanders was an atheist preacher. Night after night, he told his congregation how God would save them all, yet the first night a storm came, Mr. Sanders ran for his bunker. There is strategy behind this, but it's a strategy that assumes that the best-case scenario is a win for the Democrats. If this is only a strategic move, so be it. But it shows that the Sanders movement was far behind, not ahead of, the American populace, who is ready for a radical change and done with the duopoly status quo. What are we to make of an anarchist named Noam Chomsky, who believes that the Democrats can and should be negotiated with? I am not so much questioning Chomsky's politics, which I'm sure are left of mine. I'm more scratching my head at his strategy of electing Democrats with one hand and advocating for radical change on the other. Yes, you can believe that all government officials will be repressive by nature and that change must come from the people, although once again the progressive government figures in South America clearly contradict this. Yet for the people to gain power, we must also have some say over who runs the government. How likely would a Trump or a Clinton be to listen to progressive populists when the 1% finances their way into office? For a politician to be truly accountable to the people, they must be elected by the people, not by the 1%. It's as clear as day that the duopoly parties, as currently constructed, are not responding to the needs of the people. Yet somehow Sanders believes the best strategy for changing this is some sort of cultural shift in talking points that includes socialism. The majority of my generation believes in socialism, but that doesn't mean it will happen. Sanders was able to take advantage of popular sentiments and run a fantastic, if ultimately self-sabotaging, campaign. He quickly shuttled these sentiments back into the Democratic Party's so-called big tent. Such a strategy halts positive change in its tracks. The Democratic Party takes up space not as an ideological institution, because no one believes their crap anymore, but as an institution of governance. That is why Chomsky's strategy of changing ideology through positive movements that don't take government power, like Sanders, is so backwards. The problem isn't that people aren't radical. Most are so exploited they would easily take up a chance for revolution before Chomsky and Sanders. The problem isn't ideology. The problem is power. And the Democrats and Republicans own all the power, despite no one agreeing with anything they do. Seriously, look at Congress's approval rating. It's in the single digits in many polls. To believe the Sanders movement was a success would be to assume that working people wouldn't have a critique of capitalism on their own, maybe not in those words, but the half-century living paycheck to paycheck no doubt has a critique of the system. Assuming Sanders was a success also entails a blindness to how power works. No one is giving up power because people complain. In this country, politics change through elections. Revolutions, if Sanders even knows what that word means, are a last resort and a most likely painful resort. If this is what it takes, so be it. But we never came close to finding out. Cry no tears, though, for Sanders' blindness. His politics were never revolutionary, so why would his strategy be? Now, it is clear that lesser evil voting is not the only thing that got us here. Democrats and Republicans don't simply get worse because of how we vote. To borrow from Bernie Sanders, the reason is longer hours for lower wages. The people are less secure in their jobs, have less time and energy for politics, and are more disconnected from each other in the age of technology. The press is corrupted, wealth has been consolidated, and the pushback against the 1960s is real. No matter who we voted for over the last half decade, we may not have stopped what was happening. Still, if electoral politics make any impact, we should address it. To me, it seems impossible to separate electoral politics from radical politics, because the question one really should have is this: what are we waiting for? Yes, at this point in time, electing anyone on the left seems impossible, and yes, it seems absolutely hopeless in the near future. But these things can change fast. A movement can be ignited, and if in the middle mindset of stopping Republicans when this movement comes along, if we're in that mindset of stopping Republicans, we will simply miss our moment. If we feel the need to suppress our hope for something better because we fear something worse, who have we become? Now, this is where it all gets a little theoretical and impractical. I don't want to lose anybody here. The odds are against us, certainly, but this is a culture that relies on feelings, not rational arguments. Politics has always run this way, actually. This is the central mistake to the liberal strategy. Working people are far more rational than Sanders, Chomsky, and so forth. There is a clear recognition that Democrats in politics, and we know it is, are not giving concrete changes for the better. Only a hyper-rationality totally diverse from reality could continue to blind itself to the living reality of most people. It is rational to dump the Democrats now. It is emotional to scold people abandoned by them for being too idealistic. It is idealistic to believe in the Democrats when they continue to bring us backwards. So let me repeat that again. He is saying, the writer of this article, it is rational to dump the Democrats now. It is emotional to scold people abandoned by them for being too idealistic. It is idealistic to believe in the Democrats That is, it is simply idealistic to believe in the Democrats, yet they continue to bring us backward. It is far more level-headed decision to invest in something that will change the lives of you and your loved ones for the better. Even if that something doesn't exist yet, it's a better investment. And abandoning that change before it even starts, how rational is that? Speaking of rational, Chomsky would do well to listen to the most effective political figure of our time, the great Ralph Nader. Nader is as close to a one-man revolution as they come. He has spent years engaging in real politics with real power, never losing sight of strategy and purpose. Nader is so level-headed, one almost laughs with joy upon hearing him. The rest of the political class is reactionary and ahistorical. So when Nader was asked about third-party voting on his radio show the other week, he gave a response far less emotional than Chomsky's scoldings. He simply pointed to the historical effectiveness of third parties. He said how grateful he was that people voted for anti-slavery, women's suffrage, and industrial workers' parties when they were unpopular. Franklin D. Roosevelt, perhaps the most progressive president in U.S. history, was pushed to the left by third parties, Nader explains. In progressive moments in our country, there was a viable third-party force capable of taking away votes from the Democrats. Therefore, Democrats had to adopt some of the platforms they proposed. What a rational approach compared to the sheepdog Bernie Sanders approach. If Democrats know you are going to roll over, they will never take you seriously. This is the exact reason why Republicans never negotiate with Democrats. Dems always cave. It's sad that people blame Ralph Nader, for George W. Bush when he's one of the only people who has seriously fought Republicans. Sometimes I feel like we are enlisted to represent the Democrats, not the Democrats to represent us. I see more complaints this time of year about third-party people than about the Democrats themselves. If Democrats want people to vote for them, they should show us something. Why is it the people's job to prove themselves to the Democrats? Ralph, it's hard to find a more satisfying name than Noam, like Noam Chomsky, but I think Ralph might get the cake. Ralph Nader recognizes it as a small amount of the population. He says only 1% being politically engaged that will change society. He knows many people may be under a propaganda glaze or inactivity spell, but Ralph argues that the people know what's up. Third-party movements simply are movements that come from the ground up and therefore represent a large portion of the population's interest. Whether or not the third parties get the necessary funds to compete in an election, they can prove to the Democrats that there are votes to be gained on the left. There is a needless debate over whether to overthrow the Democratic Party from the inside or the outside. Both approaches will be necessary. There are still great people in the Democratic Party, especially at the local level. These people are worth fully supporting and organizing for, but that is in spite of their party affiliation, not because of it. If a candidate with similar characteristics is outside of the Democratic Party, that's great too. Too often the left falls into a cult-like trance of purity and scapegoating in its obsession over the Democratic Party. There are many decent people in government, and the left should not be so cynical about government as a whole, in my opinion. Donald Trump's purging of the government agencies shows why we should be inclined to trust the public sector a whole lot more than the private sector. Donald Trump ran a campaign on the idea of it's all corrupt and drain the swamp. Unless we recognize the government can, is, and will be a force for good, we are no different than the cynical capitalist, Trump. That being said, the Democratic Party is falling fast to corporate power, and there is no hope to save the organization. If the Democratic Party ever meant something, count Bill Clinton, not Donald Trump, as the worst president this country has ever seen. Bernie Sanders was right to originally run as a Democrat. This strategic play got him more coverage and credibility than other independent voices, and he took advantage. Of course, the mainstream media barely covered Sanders and were extremely unfair to him when they did, but the Democrat label helped him. This only points to a point, though. This only works to a point. When the party completely undermines its own candidates because they don't fit the corporate interests of the company, it is time to defeat this force from the outside. Continuing business as usual, as if you weren't cheated, is as dishonest as it is strategically flawed. Sanders looked pathetic as he raised arms with Hillary Clinton in a unity vote. It made no sense, and nobody fell for it. This begs the question, is it even possible for the Democratic Party to be progressive? At the presidential level, certainly not. Increasingly across the country, the answer is turning from a small chance of progressive politics to an absolute no. The Democrats continue to become more and more indebted to corporate interests, and none of these people are worth coming close to, let alone supporting. If there are good people in the Democratic Party, it just remains a more and more difficult task to be a good person within that framework. So how to defeat this trend? Is it really to simply bring the party to the left through rigged primaries? Not only are the progressives sabotaged by their own party, their loss inevitably leads to the sentiments of the progressives staying within the party, and therefore the votes, time, money, and resources of their supporters stay there too. This would be fine if it actually worked, but as long as, in other words, because you got these rigged primaries, you might as well stay in the Democratic Party because, for example, during these elections, you're only going to get to vote for a Democrat or a Republican. That's my addition to this article. But as long as the party is confident that the progressives will stay with them no matter what, why would they ever change? Remember the marvelous Ralph Nader saying that it was third-party pressure that really made some of the great progressive moves of Democrats over the years, whether that be ending slavery, giving women the vote, or the New Deal. This foolish strategy of sticking with the Democrats no matter what is being abandoned, though. And it's mostly, I'm proud to say, by younger people. Only 28% of the people aged 18 to 29 said they were certain they were voting this midterm election, according to a poll by Vox. Compare that to 74% of seniors in the same poll. There is, of course, the real consequences of this. Seniors vote Republican and keep them in office. However, would we really feel more secure about our future if the younger people were voting at the same clip? Isn't it at least a sign of hope that young people are disillusioned enough not to believe in either corporate party? And if the Democrats cared, they would try to win over this demographic. But young people remain far too left for them to even try. Note the Clinton campaign's strategy of winning over suburban Republicans before even going near working class or young Democrats of the Sanders variety. Now, the not voting is a good sign, but it's not a sufficient action. If one is going to boycott the Democrats, a worthy endeavor, an alternative must be put in its place. Without this, we are left with the only politically active people being conservative Democrats and even more conservative Republicans. Still, the rationale for abandoning Democrats is spot on and a sign of hope. The Democrats haven't come close to solving the mass inequality, the coming climate change apocalypse, the permanent war economy, the closing of local businesses and schools, the diabolical prison system, or any of the other major problems of our times. The mainstream talking heads naturally view abandoning the Democrats as the sign of despair. They are incapable of seeing it any other way. It is their party, after all. But I disagree. It's a sign that we smell bullshit and we aren't going to take it anymore. How to actually defeat the corporate duopoly is a much grander challenge, though, and if the Sanders campaign taught us anything, it is that symbolism and dissatisfaction with the status quo does nothing on its own. Maybe this is giving the Democrats too much credit, but at their best, the Democrats represent a sort of benchmark for how evil the Republicans can become. For the duopoly sham to work, differences between the two parties need to be established. As the left loses power and the Democrats feel no need to listen to it, they can lower the bar. This gives the Republicans permission to lower their bar even further, which of course they will. That is why I've always questioned the idea that a vote for a regressive Democrat is a vote against an even more regressive Republican. In short, the reason that duopoly stays as conservative as it is, not because too many people vote third party. It's precisely the opposite. Not nearly enough do. Too many people throw up their hands and say, there's no difference. And too many people throw up their hands and say, we can do better than a Democrat. This sort of defeatism is exactly what leaves the duopoly comfortable enough to negotiate policy with each other and their corporate masters rather than with the people they represent. And it's not like the Democrats really need our votes. They do not deal with voter suppression and gerrymandering because they want a fair fight with Republicans. They know Republicans need to cheat to keep up with them, and they let them do it. Half the country already doesn't vote. The idea that it all comes down to a few lefties suiting up for the Democrats is completely artificial. It's also a battle at the margins. The Green Party is really a very small party at the moment. The much bigger party is the party of people who don't vote because they see no reason to. Organize even a tenth of this demographic to come out and vote for a third option, and you would have something the major parties would have to negotiate with. For now, they have us on a loop. Republicans can be home for your dumb, mean, and rich. Democrats can be home for everyone else. Republicans can cheat to keep up as long as they stay close and as long as they remain even more awful than the Democrats. Resistance within the Democratic Party will be politely smothered and alluded to, but never taken seriously, because they know that no one is leaving and they know you have no place to go. Meanwhile, both parties will get more and more corporate. But what can you do? The challenge then is this. Build a tent outside of the duopoly capable of threatening the lesser evil agreement between the Democrats, Republicans, and corporate masters. If need be, this tent must be willing to sacrifice short-term losses for long-term gains. The strategy of defensive short-term losses after defensive short-term loss leads to, rather than prevents, the collapse of civil society and the birth of fascism, a.k.a. the creep, respectfully known as Mr. Cheeto-in-Chief. There it is, a rational case for third parties. But let's return to emotion. It's not that rationality and education and science aren't necessary. Donald Trump proves that our society needs these things. But we also acknowledge that our professional class is completely out of touch. Our society is so divided and segregated that most of the talking heads and politicians really have no idea what is going on in the country. Tucked away into our own bubbles of comfort, the professional class loses all sense of the people. This is why Nader, who hits the ground running every day, seems almost singular in his accuracy and effectiveness, at least among mainstream figures. With this in mind, let's continue to why Trump works and Democrats remain, despite being far less hideous, no more appealing. Liberals believe that convincing people that climate change is real will change how they vote. My first question is this. How dumb do you liberals think people are? People have eyes. Climate change happens. Also, we are not going to die from Mexicans or aliens or whatever. But yeah, these things work because they're about feelings. Trump lies. Everyone knows it. Some people care and some people don't. Trump, among others, was a rebellion against the rational politics. He was a rebellion against the automaton of political discourse and human interaction. He was a rebellion against the intellectual severity of the Democrats and the morally bankrupt intellectual class. I would never place Noam Chomsky in this class. He's a great person. He has never lost sight of the people's struggle. But I think he overestimates the power of rational thought. Minds are always changed through inspiration. The people who changed the world radically for the better were not just great thinkers, but great dreamers. Martin Luther King Jr. inspired because he had a vision. The vision never came, but we tried like hell to get there. No one is going to be inspired or motivated by, they're not Republicans. Ultimately, it is the privileging of the intellectual that blinds intellectuals to radical change. Through changing minds, it can be said we can inspire greatness. How has that worked out for the intellectuals themselves? The battle over power will be won by winning over the hearts. For no sacrifice for the greater good has ever been rational. It has always been necessary. What will inspire the overworked and underpaid to risk their livelihoods? It won't be an intellectual argument about capitalism. It will be a real chance at radical change for the better. This is why Democrats never get votes. They never come through. So why would anyone waste time and money they don't have in helping them get power? What the liberal professional class needs to do is embrace the magic again. If you want to leave traditional religion behind, fine. But you have to find some purpose, some vision that will ignite the people. If you don't believe in something greater than we have now, you aren't going to motivate or inspire anyone else. This is why I use the quote from the politically active Emma Watson, who is most famous for her role as the witch, Hermione Granger, in the Harry Potter series. In the massively popular fantasy series, there are four houses that a witch or a wizard can be sorted into. And I'm going to mispronounce these names, folks, because I'm not a Harry Potter fan. Gryffindor is for the brave. Hufflepuff is for the kind. Ravenclaw is for the smart. And Slytherin is for the cunning. Well, maybe I didn't. The four houses work as a useful metaphor for this country. Democrats and Republicans actually account for only a quarter of the country each, while independents account for half. Republicans are clearly Slytherin. They're evil and selfish and morally bankrupt. The liberals are Ravenclaw, for they believe that if we are rational, all our problems will be solved. Ultimately, this movement fails as soon as the Republicans play to people's anxieties and fears. No one except for intellectuals likes to be numb and devoid of feeling. The Bernie movement is Hufflepuff, for they believe in a kinder and gentler Scandinavia model. Ultimately, this movement has no bite and is stopped when the big boys come out to play. Then there are the Gryffindors. this is the only house that can actually defeat the Slytherins, led by Don Voldemort. One can rationalize with evil people and save a few lives. One can negotiate with people, evil people, and save a few lives. But the only way to defeat evil is with courage. Now, Hermione Granger was a fascinating character because she was the smartest person in the book. I would argue that she was even smarter than the Chomsky-like Albus Dumbledore, but that's a debate for a different time. Everyone was surprised when she ended up in Gryffindor because she was most suited for Ravenclaw, but the Sorting Hat who decides such things says that ultimately the choice is yours. And that's an extremely long article, 40 minutes long, by Nick Pemberton. Reflections on Chomsky's voting strategy, why the Democratic Party can't be saved, is what he calls it. What it's really about, though, is lesser evil voting. After this musical break, I'm going to read you the opposite side of this, a man responding to Nick Pemberton who disagrees with him and believes lesser evil voting is a good idea. And since some of you will be voting in the next few days, and some of you don't like voting for either of the folks that are being offered as a sort of a Burger King or McDonald's choice, it may be worth considering.
Elections are approaching and a story will be told. Is there more than just resistance? Or is it all just lies and empty promises? Lies we detest, still we all just hear what we want to hear and disregard the rest. Would you rather vote for honesty, even if you disagree, than descend into the perils of those who simply tell you what you want to hear? Or do you think you can pick between an offer of the lesser of two lies, searching for the truth and moral compromise? Lie to lie, can you tell when you are being told a lie? Lie, 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 lie. There's a lie that is pervasive, says there's only red or blue and the other choices are wasted votes that undermine democracy. A wasted vote is when you choose a candidate against your personal beliefs.
Lie, more like resource application, lie, 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 lie.
And that was Lie, Lie, Lie by the Parody Project. You're tuned to the stream of free radio at freakradio.org or possibly one of the archives on the Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom website, where you can find many more older programs just like this one at huffsantacruz.org, all one word, all small letters. And my apologies for not breaking up that last long reading of the Counterpunch article with a at least a little music, if nothing else. I'll try not to do that again, because here's another article in response to Nick Pemberton's article. This is an article by Chris Wright, which was published on October 23rd, not long after the article by Nick Pemberton. It's called The Necessity of Lesser Evil Voting. It's election time again, that joyous time of the biennium, and you know what that means, a renewal of the perennial left-wing debate over lesser evil voting. Is it wrong to vote for a Democrat rather than someone on the genuine left in order to keep a reactionary or a fascist out of power? Or, on the contrary, is it wrong to vote for a leftist who has apparently no chance of victory, thereby denying a vote to the Democrat and so increasing the odds that the reactionary candidate will win? The most famous advocate of lesser evil voting is Noam Chomsky, who argues that the most immediate moral imperative is to prevent the worst possible electoral outcome from occurring. Critics of lesser evil voting are legion, as a simple Google search indicates. The writer Nick Pemberton recently contributed to this debate in a Counterpunch article. It's a long and rambling article, most of which isn't worth responding to. Nevertheless, since Pemberton has resurrected the issue, I'd like to weigh in on the side of reason and morality. Maybe a miracle will happen and I'll reach one or two people. It's to the credit of Pemberton and many of his allies in this debate that they acknowledge it's a risky proposition to disagree with Chomsky. The man has a preternatural ability to be rational and right about nearly everything, and on this issue, too, I think he's absolutely right and his critics are wrong. Now, if Chomsky can't convince the critics, then I certainly can't, but hopefully I can at least provide a bit of food for thought. One way to approach the issue is to list policy differences between Democrats and Republicans that leftists should care about. The claim is often made that the two parties are effectively indistinguishable, but this is hardly the case. Consider net neutrality, an issue leftists care about. Where do the parties stand on it? Obama's FCC voted in favor of it on party lines, while Trump's FCC ended it. Not exactly indistinguishable. On global warming, Obama was pathetically inadequate, but during his term, the U.S. did at least join the Paris Agreement. Trump withdrew from it. Obama's EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, introduced rules to cut pollution from vehicle tailpipes, while Trump's is rolling those rules back. Trump is enamored of coal, Obama wasn't. Trump's EPA has proposed to dramatically weaken regulations concerning mercury, posing a threat to the nervous systems of children and fetuses. The differences go on and on. On the Supreme Court, how likely is it that Hillary Clinton would have nominated judges as reactionary as Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch? Clinton cares about Roe v. Wade and would certainly not have would have nominated people likely to protect its legacy. This is a major issue, not a trivial difference between the parties. In general, the liberals on the court are hardly indistinguishable from the conservatives, as this list of some of the major decisions in 2018 shows. And there's a bunch of decisions. In a separate article, the Supreme Court's biggest decisions in 2018, labor unions 5-4, the court ruled that government workers who choose not to join unions may not be required to help pay for collective bargaining, considered an anti-union decision. Travel ban 5-4, the court ruled that President Trump had the legal authority to restrict travel from several mostly Muslim countries. Pregnancy centers and abortion 5-4, the court blocked a California law that required crisis pregnancy centers, that is to say pro-life anti-abortion centers or anti-choice centers, to provide information about abortion. Digital privacy, the court ruled that the government generally needs a warrant to collect troves of location data about the customers of cell phone companies. That was a good decision as distinguished from the previous decisions for those who are so minded. Internet sales taxes. The court ruled that the states can require internet retailers to collect sales taxes in states where they have no physical presence. I don't know much about that decision. Partisan gerrymandering. The court sent the challenge back to Wisconsin's legislative map to the lower courts. Everybody voted for that one. And there's a number of other decisions that I won't go through, but I'll continue with reading Mr. Wright's article. The entire 20th century history of the court indicates the same thing, most notably from the New Deal on. What about workers' rights? The Democratic Party has little loyalty to organized labor, as evidenced by NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, among innumerable other betrayals. But Obama did at least sign the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act of 2009, which I'd never heard of before I read this article, in addition to a number of pro-worker executive orders to which McCain, who was his opponent in the 2008 election, was opposed. And Obama's Labor Department and National Labor Relations Board were far friendlier to workers than Trump's administration has been. The foreign policies of the parties are much more similar than their domestic policies, being in fact virtually identical on issue after issue. I'm not going to defend the Democratic Party's foreign policy, but it's worth noting that George W. Bush's Iraq War would probably not have occurred had Al Gore been president, since Gore had fewer ties to neoconservatives and the oil industry than Bush and Cheney did. That is, a world historic catastrophe that resulted in hundreds of thousands of deaths, millions of refugees, and the destruction of a country quite possibly could have been avoided had more people voted for Gore over Bush in swing states in 2000. Is such a cataclysmic war worth preventing? I think so. Apparently, critics of lesser evil voting disagree. Now, I got to say, I'm reading this without giving my sarcastic commentary, which I'm going to leave to Nick Pemberton, who responds to this article after it's finished. Speaking of the 2000 election, the frequent denials that Ralph Nader contributed to Bush's victory are nonsense. Bush defeated Gore in Florida by 537 votes. Nader received 97,421 votes in Florida. Had only 538 of the people who voted for Nader voted for Gore instead, there would have been no Bush administration and quite possibly no Iraq War. It's a matter of simple arithmetic and shouldn't be controversial. Of course, there were thousands of additional reasons why Gore lost, including perhaps the Monica Lewinsky scandal, his blandly centrist political positions, decisions his campaign made, and so on. But it's mathematically provable that one of the reasons was Nader's campaign in Florida. The reason-defying power of ideological thinking is such that people are not able to deny not only elementary morality, that you should prevent the worst possible outcome, but even elementary arithmetic. It's remarkable. I won't continue listing differences between the two major parties, though there are many more. Instead, let's consider some of the other arguments. A common formulation is that the lesser evil is still evil, to which I'd reply, sure. You can phrase it that way if you want, and maybe you're right to do so. But the point is that there are degrees of evil. Indeed, that's all we're confronted with in politics, greater and lesser evils. You shouldn't look for moral and ideological purity in the messy realm of politics. Even far-left candidates will almost never be perfect reflections of your values. There will be political sins in their past. They'll take stands on issues that you won't agree with. And if elected, they'll almost inevitably make compromises that will disappoint you. The designation lesser evil voting is misleading because all voting is lesser evil voting. Even if you vote for the most radical Green Party candidate, you're still choosing what you think is the lesser evil because no candidate is absolutely perfect. You vote for the one who will do the least damage or will serve your moral values most effectively. And again, one of your values should be to prevent the worst possible outcome. You can pretend you're being pure somehow by voting against the Democrat or not voting at all, but depending on the political context, what your feel-good voting strategy is accomplishing might only be to empower the candidate who will, say, pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement, step up the war on immigrants, end net neutrality, ratchet up the capitalist war on humanity and the environment, and give white supremacy a prominent platform. I'm not saying you should necessarily actively campaign for a Democrat just to prevent the Republican from winning, although that's quite a reasonable thing to do if you don't want the fascist to win. But surely it isn't too much to ask that on one day every 2 years you cast a vote against fascism and on every other day get back to the task of building a socialist movement. The claim is often made that lesser evil voting has enabled the rightward drift of U.S. politics since the 1980s. This claim would have more merit if there had existed a third party with even a remote chance of electoral success. But the fact is that the rightward drift of politics has overwhelmingly resulted from the business community's multidimensional mobilization against democracy, not merely from people's voting for a Democrat every 2 or 4 years. Incomparably more important than voting, at least as long as viable third parties don't exist, is, on the one hand, the work of challenging and pressuring Democrats once they're in power, and on the other hand, the work of building a radical social movement outside the voting booth. The latter task takes decades. Not until it has been accomplished does it make much sense to embrace the sort of electoral strategy Nader has followed. One argument I haven't heard Chomsky make is that having Democrats in power is useful because it shows people the flaws of the Democratic Party and thus the necessity of building a socialist movement. If only Republicans were ever in power, people might think all problems could be solved just by electing Democrats, any Democrat. And that's the goal they would focus on. When Democrats in power show how corrupt and oligarchical they too are, then anti-capitalist movements like Occupy Wall Street and the current widespread activism for, quote, democratic socialism can emerge to push for systematic changes in the political economy. In this sense, Obama's presidency advanced the political education of millions of Americans who realized that electing centrist Democrats wasn't enough. In the end, one's opponents or interlocutors will always have some stock answer to every argument, no matter how logical the argument is. Leftists who loathe the Democratic Party with apparently every fiber of their being will always have some rationale, however specious, to justify never voting for a Democrat. Even for a Democrat like, say, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is, or seems, manifestly better on most issues than nearly all Democrats. The very word Democrat is for many leftists little more than a term of abuse, a curse word, as it is for so many Republicans, a term so value-laden that the idea of voting for such a person is nauseating. But investing political labels with primarily emotional content is neither useful nor rational and can lead to demonstrably stupid, even totalitarian thinking and acting. We should try to step back from our visceral hatreds and aversions and consider dispassionately what course of action is likely to ameliorate the most human suffering. And that's really all that matters. If you think letting the House or Senate remain in Republican hands is a price worth paying for voting for an ideologically correct candidate who has no chance of winning, so be it. But I'll bet a lot of immigrants who are finding it much harder to get a visa now than under Obama would disagree with you, as would perhaps quite a few environmental activists who are now desperately working overtime to prevent Ryan Zinke's Department of the Interior from stripping yet another national park or monument of federal protection. When semi-fascism is appearing on the horizon or is already in power, the imperative is to build a united front against fascism. That the Communist Party in the period of the Popular Front was right about this. It's time to apply the hard-won lessons of the past. And that's an article by Chris Wright, The Necessity of Lesser Evil Voting.
Looking at you tonight, there's something I'd like to do tonight, and I believe in abstinence only, but I don't wanna leave you lonely, so abstain with me, baby. Frame me, baby, all night long. I'm gonna wanna jump your bones. I'm gonna have to dump that Jones. So come on now, get stoned in lover's lane with me. Abstain with me. When you're not there, I'm blue. baby, I think you know where I'm blue. And I remember sex education as approved by the administration. So abstain with me, baby. Feel the strain with me, babe. All night long. We're gonna have the urge to merge. An urge we're gonna have to purge on the verge. So come on now. Be an excruciating pain with me. Abstain. And go bowling or something. Come on now. Try not to split a vein with me. Abstain with me.
And that was one from old Roy Zimmerman, one of his albums, Faulty Intelligence, and it was called, of course, Abstain With Me. So think about that for a bit. And now, at the risk of putting everyone to sleep, after all, this is the Election Eve broadcast, here's the response that Nick Pemberton made in Counterpunch 3 days later, after apparently reading and chewing on Mr. Wright's article that you just heard about the value of lesser evil voting. He wrote a less long and rambling response to lesser evil voting. So here goes. I was pleased to see an article calling me a long rambling earlier this week. It was an article advocating lesser evil voting by underground humanist Chris Wright and can be read here. My original long and rambling article was on Counterpunch last week. I was so excited by a left hook from a leftist, I thought I'd respond. Mr. Wright never says anything wrong in his article. His name is Wright, after all. But like Noam Chomsky, he never addresses the more legitimate arguments against lesser evil voting. Wright really likes Noam. He linked to a beautiful piece he wrote on the good professor in his article. I like Noam, too, but no one is preternatural, as Wright claims Chomsky is. Noam is, after all, basically a muggle with a big brain. But I digress. For being so smart, Wright and Chomsky swipe at low-hanging fruit. Most of Wright's article is establishing policy differences between Democrats and Republicans. While informative on specific issues, the overall point was pretty much useless if he was really trying to appeal to the other side of lesser evil voting. We all know Democrats are better than Republicans. If he was responding to me, I probably said that a dozen times in my long and rambling piece. Wright's article is titled The Necessity of Lesser Evil Voting. So there is an implicit knowledge that all sides of the debate know that there is a lesser evil and a greater evil. Hence the name. But what Wright and Chomsky fail to recognize is that the two parties are not better or worse on happenstance, but by design. A vote for the lesser evil is a vote against the greater evil, but it is also a vote for the system of lesser evil politics that basically gives the public no say in policy while handing all power over to corporate interests. It's what Glenn Ford calls a gentleman's agreement between the two corporate parties. For lesser evil voting to remain legitimate, there has to be a difference between the two parties. It's in the interest of both parties to show a difference from the other, because then someone who is politically inclined will choose the option they like best. If it were the same, why would anyone vote for either of them? It's just how the free market system works. Will McDonald's and Burger King have the same burgers? Of course not. Neither of them would want to. Some people prefer the brand of liberalism. Some people prefer the brand of conservatism. Voting primarily works as a consumer-driven market in the U.S. these days. Buy Democrat, or Republicans will kick out all the immigrants. Buy Republican, or the Democrats will open the border. One would be right to point out that these aren't equal statements. Republicans will kick out the immigrants, which puts moral people in the position to vote Democrats. But Democrats will not open the border, so the Republican ideology is always safe under the lesser evil system, which is one of the reasons one should despise it. The next point by Mr. Wright was to blame Ralph Nader for George W. Bush. This was odd, but Wright was being logical, sticking to the Chomsky playbook. He counted the votes and concluded that if Nader hadn't run, Gore would have won. It's simple math. Once again, an obvious point that doesn't cut to the core of the lesser evil system. In this particular case, if one takes out all the variables except for Nader choosing to run, then yes, Gore is our president. Wright says there is a chance there was no Iraqi war under Gore, but I disagree. Regardless, I'll take Wright's point that Gore was better than Bush. But it's so delusional to point to third-party candidates as the reason Republicans win half the time. For one, Wright refuses to address that Nader's platform was closer to the ideology of the average American than either of the corporate parties. There was a way for Gore to get Nader's votes. Adopt his policies. Maybe Mr. Wright would respond by saying that Gore wouldn't get any corporate money if he became like Nader and therefore would lose. Also a good point by the theoretical Mr. Wright. But take the candidacy of a remarkable Bernie Sanders, who took no corporate money and was therefore seen as a victory by Chomsky. Chomsky saw Bernie as a victory, even though Bernie lost. But as soon as a third-party candidate is in the race and loses, without any corporate money to speak of, then they are seen as a failure, and even blamed for the GOP. Is Bernie left off the hook because he is a Democrat? Now, there are outcomes to be achieved by candidates running without corporate money. Either they win outright or they become enough of a threat to the corporate parties that they have to adopt some of their platforms. Neither of these things will happen under the lesser evil voting philosophy. The third party doesn't have to win to have an impact, but they have to be a legitimate threat. Undermining them before they become this is just sabotage. A vote for the lesser evil is a vote for corporate power. Third parties are failing, but not for the reason Wright claims. Third parties are failing because they are in the middle ground. A few people like them, but most people are too scared to go near them. If Wright and Chomsky had their way, they'd be dead and gone, and the Democrats would, in theory, have a better chance against the Republicans. But given the current state of affairs, where fascist Republicans steal elections and bully Democrats, all they want just to keep up, what is it to say there wouldn't be another gentleman's agreement to even the score if the Democrats did pull ahead in the absence of a third party? To the contrary, if more people voted third party, Democrats would have to appeal to us or risk extinction. Wright dumbs down third party voters so much it makes me wonder if the humans he met underground were humans at all. The reason-defying power of ideological thinking is such that people are able to deny not only elementary morality, he's quoting Wright here, that you should prevent the worst possible outcome, but even elementary arithmetic. They deny elementary arithmetic. It's remarkable. Also, what's with that word remarkable, and why do Chomsky and Wright keep remarking it? After listing the differences between the two parties for a long time, Wright takes mercy on us. But he then goes into a philosophical discussion about degrees of evil, something Chomsky also did. A whole paragraph is devoted to the point that there are degrees of evil, as in there is such a thing as one thing being greater than another. Chomsky was obsessed with this point too, but is this breaking new ground? I'll return to the burgers. It's really about as silly a point as saying the Big Mac is bigger than another burger. Yes, obviously, it's called a Big Mac. There is such a thing as things being greater or lesser than. Who are we talking to now? Then there is the purity argument, another one we've all heard before that's out of the mainstream media's playbook. It's a smear and a dishonest one. I don't think most people walk to the voting booth with the idea that they are washing their hands of sin because they vote third party. It's really the other way around. When has anyone in the mainstream media made you feel guilty for voting Democrat? Vote for Democrat and you saved immigrants, one hears. Vote for Green and you killed the immigrants, one hears. Why repeat this rubbish as if it's original rather than a corporate talking point? If one wants to make a rational argument for voting Democrat, fine, there's room to maneuver, but don't pretend like the other side doesn't care as much as you do. Wright then moves to his strongest paragraph, where he says that lesser evil voting hasn't caused a rightward shift in our politics. I would concur that at this point it's a correlation, but not necessarily a causation. Wright correctly points out that a movement outside of election politics is needed, but he ruins this momentum when he says that Nader should have only run after a movement outside of electoral politics is made. Why not both? And how on earth can one bury and blame people like Nader and expect the movement to grow? Is the movement supposed to happen magically? Why does the left continue to shoot itself in the foot before things even get started? Wright then argues that electing Democrats is useful because it proves they are inadequate and therefore that we need something better. First off, what is that something better if you're going to vote for the Democrat regardless? But the broader point is that in the duopoly consciousness we all live under, the only alternative to Democrats is Republicans. So when Democrats fail, we get Republicans, not socialists. I mean, really, if Wright wants to point to the Democrats' failings opening a door, why not leave it open? But for now, in our duopoly system, Democrats' failure is the Republicans' biggest weapon, and Republicans' failure is the Democrats' biggest weapon. The failure of the Democrats directly led to the fascist Donald Trump. In the last paragraphs, typical scare tactics are used. I sympathize with it. Republicans, especially Trump, are making things a whole lot worse for a whole lot of people. I have no problem with anyone who votes and campaigns for Democrats. I have in the past and will in the future, provided they aren't funded by giant corporations. If there is a green, even better. However, the question remains, how do we get leverage in a lesser evil system? Organized resistance on the streets, yes, but what about electoral politics? Does the current system present options against fascism, or does it only provide roads to it? Let's not forget that Donald Trump succeeded by pointing to political figures on both sides of the aisle and saying, you haven't done enough. As long as politics remains as is, he can say these things and be right. As long as the corporate duopoly runs as currently constructed, the only opposition available to corporatism will be fascism. As long as left-wing popular movements are undermined by the Democrats, right-wing fascist popular movements will overtake the country. To overcome Trump, sustained courage will be needed both in electoral politics and elsewhere. To help explain the left, Wright unsurprisingly links to a piece of writing he wrote called Thoughts on Stupidity. But maybe, Mr. Wright, stupidity isn't the problem. Maybe people make stupid choices because there are stupid options. And that's the response that Nick Pemberton has to Chris Wright. And the name of Pemberton's second article is A Less Long and Rambling Response to a Lesser Evil Voting. And now, as a bonus for having listened to all that, if you have, or maybe you sort of listened to the droning of my voice and waited for the music, here's the musical break.
Inglés es la lengua madre. No sé quién es el padre. Inglés es la lengua nacional de los Estados Unidos. Así pues, limpien mi baño, por favor, y bienvenidos. Inglés es la lengua madre.
English is the mother tongue.
No sé quién es el padre.
I don't know who the father is.
Inglés es la lengua nacional de los Estados Unidos.
English is the national language of the United States.
Así pues, limpien mi baño, por favor.
So please clean my bathroom.
Y bienvenidos.
And welcome.
Nuestro ministro de justicia es Alberto González.
Our attorney general is Alberto González.
Un hombre que cree en el imperio de la ley uberales.
A man who believes in the rule of law, uberales.
Su gente venía a este país desde Sonora.
His people came to this country from Sonora.
y ahora encerran su Mercedes por $4 por hora.
And now they wax his Mercedes for $4 an hour.
Y no más and no more. A propósito, hoy estamos contratando a gente como ustedes para construir un muro de 17 pies para excluir a gente como ustedes. And by the way, today we're hiring people like you to build a 17-foot wall to keep out people like you. Inglés es la lengua madre. English is the mother tongue. No sé quién es el padre. I don't know who the father is. Inglés es la lengua nacional de los Estados Unidos. What he said. Así pues, cosechen mis uvas, por favor.
So please harvest my grapes.
Lleven mis niños a la escuela.
And take my kids to school.
Y cambien el pañal de mi abuelo.
And change my grandpa's diaper.
Y bienvenidos.
And welcome.
And that was Inglés from Zimmerman's album Faulty Intelligence. And there's more where that came from. And you'll be hearing more of that, or from that album, or from other albums soon.